From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
My first guests today both hold top positions in the Democratic Party, but they say that they've tried to set aside partisan politics in order to co-write a book about their vision for America. They're Rahm Emanuel, a congressman from Illinois' 5th District, and Bruce Reed, the president of the Democratic Leadership Council. Their book, The Plan, Big Ideas for America, is published by Public Affairs, and it brings Rahm Emanuel and Bruce Reed to my show today. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
At a press conference yesterday, President Bush made a pretty direct attack on Democratic congressional hopefuls. He said there are, quote, a lot of people in the Democrat Party who believe that the best course of action is to leave Iraq before the job is done, period, and they're wrong. Now, I'm sure you take offense at his characterization of the party's stance, but do you see a lot of Democrats pushing to phase down troop levels?
I was going to say, I mean, I think you must have been responding to Senator Hagel, the Republican from Nebraska, who said that we should leave in 6 months, who said the country's in the middle of a civil war. And he said it on one of the Sunday shows. So I think anybody who clearly both reads the paper and watches the news knows that after 3.5 years, 2,600 American lives, $308 billion spent, and 19,000 wounded American soldiers, and barely the green zone in Baghdad is secure, that this is not a course of success. And even Republicans like Senator Hagel, who says we should get out in 6 months, Senator McCain, who says it's not civil war, but it is civil strife and there's more bad days than good, clearly things are not on the course and all the president's offering you is more of the same.
So as the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee this year, and Bruce, as the head of the Democratic Leadership Council, what is the Democratic Party stance on Iraq? Does the party want to pull out, increase troops in order to achieve new objectives, or do something else? Is there a timetable, Bruce?
Leonard, I think on this one, I mean, look, you have Senator Biden, who 3 months ago wrote, a very smart piece in the New York Times with Leslie Gelb about seeing where the country was going in the sense of sectarian violence. There's a Kurdish area, Sunni area, and a Shiite area, and realizing that and said this could be the only way for towards a success, accept what's already happening in the country, deal with that, and have a proactive plan for it. Senator Levin, for lack of a better way of saying it, basically saw 06 as Iraqi sovereignty and 07 in the beginnings of America's redeployment. Those, at least Democrats, are offering ideas rather than, in my view, two things. The president saying stay the course and the Republican Congress saying see no evil, speak no evil, hear no evil.
But they're also saying cut and run.
No. Who's saying cut and run?
Republicans.
No, but they...
They're saying that you are
right, no, but
calling
they,
Leonard,
for cut and run.
Let's look at what the Republicans are trying to do here because this is a common tactic for the Bush administration. They have set up essentially a perpetual motion machine where they fail at national security. Democrats criticize their failure, which the Republicans then use as an excuse to call Democrats soft on national security, which gives the Republicans a little more time to continue to fail at national security. So this is just politics for them. And this fall's elections are not going to be a referendum on the Democrats' ability to run the country over the last 6 years. They're going to be a referendum on the Republicans.
But, Bruce, hasn't the DLC generally stuck by the Bush administration's decision in Iraq? The book here seems to be opposed to the war, so have you changed your stance on the war?
No, we've been very critical of how the administration has conducted the war in Iraq. Look, we've got a defense secretary who should have been fired a long time ago. The administration has let the country down, and worst of all, it has used the war on terror and the war on Iraq for domestic political purposes, which is utterly inexcusable. Never happened to this extent in wartime before. You know, usually the country is united by its efforts abroad, and this administration has taken a country that was united after 9/11 and divided it.
The Republicans seem to be more in support of Joe Lieberman now than most Democrats. If he's elected, will congressional Democrats welcome him back into their fold, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, look, Senator, first of all, that's a what if.
Well, there's a strong possibility. Right now, he leads in the polls.
He also said that he's going to caucus with the Democrats in the Senate, and if he consistently supports the Democratic efforts on raising the minimum wage, negotiating for lower prescription drug prices, there's going to be a lot to work together. And as he said in the last weeks of the campaign, his voting record is 90% consistently against the president's policies. So I think that as long as there's those common bonds, will he be welcomed? That's a what-if situation. He's agreed that he's going to work with the Democrats, and we'll cross that bridge when we get there.
It's often said that while the Republicans have a fairly unified vision, the Democrats have been a loose coalition of often conflicting interests, like all the way back when it included segregationists and liberal integrationists. And that's something that the Republicans are constantly stressing, like when President Bush, in his speech yesterday, called it the Democrat Party rather than the Democratic Party, suggesting that it's a party without a vision. So how do you deal with that? And how do you deal with it in the light of Bill Clinton's triangulation approach, which the two of you have been strong supporters of?
Well, we're a very broad political party, and we welcome that. We encourage debate and welcome new ideas. One of the reasons we have written this book is because we think that the Democratic coalition has a lot to offer and that we ought to be having the kind of debate about where the country should go and what answers we ought to offer to Americans' problems that this administration has shut down, ignored, and avoided for the last 6 years.
Let me say this. I think there's plenty. Look, Senator Kennedy's written a book. Senator Obama's about to write a book. There are plenty of ideas in the Democratic Party and also what we stand for. There are core concepts in the sense of what we talk about, which I'm most proud about in the book. Besides the individual policy initiatives, whether they're on college education, savings, or health care, is a sense that citizenship is not an entitlement program. It starts with responsibility. We use that as a concept in solving, as we stand here today on the 10-year anniversary of welfare reform becoming signed into law, and that same concept was the basis of both the Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, and what some of the ideas we offer is we want to go tackle everything from national service to corporate welfare reform and ending corporate welfare. So that concept philosophically is what binds Democrats together. That is, you take more responsibility, there'll be more opportunity for you. And so I don't buy the notion that Democrats either don't A, have a common vision, or B, have a common purpose. I do think they do. And the second thing I'll say is, you know, you can't find a single Republican today who remembers that they were for privatization of Social Security when, in fact, they were lockstep for it. And I think that our diversity and our energy and our commitment, though, to a core principle of responsibility is what unifies Democrats.
My guests are Rahm Emanuel and Bruce Reed, who have co-authored The Plan, Big Ideas for America, published by Public Affairs. Mr. Emanuel is the congressman from Illinois' 5th District, and Mr. Reed is president of the Democratic Leadership Council. You mentioned the 10th anniversary of the welfare bill, and today's Times features an op-ed piece by Bill Clinton in which he celebrates that anniversary as an example of how nonpartisan cooperation can achieve great things. And then on page A13 is a long article by Eric Eckholm that's headlined, "A Welfare Law Milestone Finds Many Left Behind." So if, as former President Clinton says, partisan rancor is the enemy of progress and the bill has been something of a mixed blessing, then isn't that one of the problems the Democratic Party is facing today?
I think the welfare reform law has been far more than a mixed blessing, as you say, as a result
many
of
left behind.
Absolutely. And we have a lot more work to do. One of the reasons that the president wrote that op-ed is to remind the country that the job isn't done, that we have a lot more work to do, that in fact has been suspension over the last 6 years to keep fighting to reduce poverty. But the welfare reform law reduced poverty among single mothers by a third over the 90s. And it's an example not just of how when people can put their political differences and partisan differences aside, we can make progress, but also that the goal of politics ought to be to find policies that work. So many in Washington are always looking to find partisan advantage. And what Bill Clinton did in the welfare reform law was to try to negotiate a new law that would fundamentally reform a broken system that people across the political spectrum found to be failing, and put forward an idea that would work. And what we've suffered from as a country over the last 6 years is that all we get are notions that are designed to achieve partisan advantage for the administration, and no focus on how to solve the real problems of real people.
Can I add one thing, though, what you just said? First of all, it's not like prior to the signing of the welfare law, you were dealing with some idyllic, perfect society. You had a broken system, a cultural dependency, as late Senator Moynihan talked about in New York, and you had a system which literally from one generation to another not only passed out a value system, but also the sense of dependency. Welfare reform, minimum wage, extending the earned income tax credit, the children's health insurance program, extending child care, Head Start reform, all went into reducing poverty, cutting the caseloads, having kids who got more health care coverage than ever before, and raising incomes for the first time for those on the low end of the economic working ladder. It has been a success. By no means is anybody spiking the ball in the end zone, but in fact, it's just saying, well, we have our work to get done. Second is, and this is where President Clinton's going to be at a book signing with us Thursday up at the Barnes & Nobles in Lincoln Center, but there was partisan politics before we reached consensus. The Republicans tried to pass two very onerous bills that the President Clinton vetoed and said that's the wrong way. They finally came around to his right way, and which was on more investment in child care, Medicaid year transition for people who work. They got health care for their kids, a couple other things. But that is why we got that consensus. There was an attempt for partisanship. He stopped that. And then when you built bipartisan consensus and also solved a problem the country had been tangling with for over 20 years.
In the last election cycle, there were a number of books that, like yours, were aimed at changing strategy for Democrats. I'm thinking of Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas, George Lakoff's Don't Think of an Elephant. And what are you doing that's different from those books? Are there many different people giving advice to the Democrats as what they should be doing?
There are a lot of people giving advice. What we tried to do in our book was start a debate that we think needs to happen this fall and in the years coming up to 2008, because our view is that unlike Dr. Lakoff, who believes that we just need to change the words we use, and Thomas Frank, who believes that we need to change the subject back to more favorable terrain, we think our fundamental responsibility is to put forward some ideas that will actually solve people's problems, and that's where Washington is completely out of sync with the rest of the country. We've gone through an administration where ordinary Americans haven't seen a raise in 5 years. They're falling behind on their health care. American business is losing ground in the global economy because health care costs are now a sixth of our overall spending. We can't put off these problems forever.
We'll take a little break and we'll come back to this new social contract that you're talking about. My guests are Rahm Emanuel and Bruce Reed, who have co-authored Big Ideas for America. It is published by Public Affairs. We're back with Rahm Emanuel and Bruce Reed. Rahm Emanuel is a congressman from Illinois' 5th District, and also is heading the campaign for Congress this year, supporting congressional candidates all over the country. And Bruce Reed is the president of the Democratic Leadership Council. Now, you say...
Can I go back to our earlier question?
Sure.
It's more like a family discussion here, since in our family, we never finish a conversation here. But
it has to be conversation anyway. The minute it becomes something else, then...
Well, we don't discuss anything in our family. We yell at each other. That's called dialogue in our family. You asked a question right before the intermission. Here's where I think Bruce and I agree with the president, which is...
You're talking about President Bush.
Yes. At this moment in time, America is facing the dual challenges of both the war on terror and the crushing and both effective and destructive elements of the global economy. That this, and he calls his time in history equal to Roosevelt, Franklin, to the sense of the dual challenges of the Depression and World War II. And but the comparison is not flattering for him. He's right about the time and moment in history, but not in the way he's managed it. Roosevelt inherited a divided country as it faced the war and united it in its mission. Bush inherited a united country on 9/11 and divided it. Roosevelt inherited a depression and built the biggest and largest middle class the world had seen. President Bush inherited the longest economic expansion in American history and then gave the middle class its greatest anxiety. And the policies he's put in place have divided America here at home, have not prepared America for the 21st century. And then the attempt we do with that moment in time is, and I think he has made a horrible blunder. You just take 9/11. Americans across this country after that were ready to do something for their country. And as we say in the book, that call out never came. Never sense a sense of challenge for what Americans would do. And then on the economic front, as China and India are building and preparing for the 21st century, from healthcare to access to college education to investments in new technology to energy independence to our tax policies to our budget, there has been no modernization or updating to handle that. Now, as Bruce and I often talk, man, we bring stories and anecdotes from the northwest side of the city of Chicago, working class area. You have on my east side of my district the unbelievable success of a global economy. It's a well-to-do area, yet I have represent a bungalow belt, over 20,000 flight attendants. And they will tell you what has happened in this unbelievable global economy to their pensions, to their pay raises, and the lack thereof, their health care coverage. And we have got to do on a public policy level is do something to modernize and prepare so that middle class dream is still available to them.
But to be fair to George Bush, he inherited a
How's
declining
economy. How does that feel, Leonard?
He inherited a declining economy. You talk about the longest expansion, but at the end of the Clinton administration, things were going down. The dot-com bubble had burst. Everybody knew that we were going to have something like a mild recession. In fact, we kind of went into it before he handed over the reins to Bush.
Yeah, but and here's where I'm not going to be fair to President Bush. College costs under his stewardship have gone up 52%, and what does he offer? A cut in college assistance. Healthcare costs are now up to $11,000 per family of four, and we've done nothing to deal with expanding coverage. Energy costs, when he got signed into, when he took his oath, was $1.33 a gallon. And today, what did we do? We gave $12.5 billion to Big Oil. At every opportunity we had to do something to help America, he chose to help the special interests.
In this book, you say that the real divide in Washington isn't between the Democrats and Republicans, but between wonks and hacks. Would you define the two terms for us, Bruce? And what would you call yourselves?
Well, in our experience, there really are two kinds of people. Political hacks who focus primarily on political outcomes, and policy wonks who are interested in finding ideas that work. Now, the political system needs both of these characters to fight with one another and find some common ground. What's happened in the last 6 years is that the political hacks have taken over the Bush administration and the Republican Congress, and we've had an attack of what we call the Rove flu, which is
how is that all that different from triangulation, which was an attempt to
well, we had a different theory in the Clinton administration. Bill Clinton's
it was all about
view,
winning, wasn't it?
Bill Clinton's view was, and this he honed this for 12 years as a governor, was that the way to win over the long term was to put forward ideas that actually worked. And, you know, if you look at his record in the 90s on the economy, on welfare, on crime, on a host of other social issues, his ideas actually worked. And for the long haul, that's the only way that a political party is going to make progress. Rather than the Karl Rove approach, which is try to get as many of your voters to the polls for one election, try to fool the country into thinking that the other guys are worse than you, and maybe you'll get enough votes to stay in office. Maybe you can attack the other guys enough to get by. But, you know, in the long run, Democratic Party's only going to win if America wins, and we need to end this hack attack that we've had in Washington.
So why do you think the Democrats haven't been more successful? For example, when Randy Cunningham was drummed out of office, his seat went to another Republican. You would have thought, considering the extent of the scandal there, that there would have been a major reaction.
Well, I'll do that since that's my...
you knew Randy.
Duke Cunningham? Yeah. First of all, that district is an overwhelming Republican district.
So what does it take to turn those people?
Well, I mean, had Duke Cunningham stayed? I mean, as you notice, Tom DeLay is too scared to go face the voters. Bob Ney is too scared to face the voters. If any one of those individuals who have even had the courage to, I mean, Duke Cunningham is now in jail, so he had no choice, and a couple of the others will be facing soon their time and questions for themselves. But the fact is that had they stayed, they would have gotten defeated. Those districts, it deals with the larger issue that we talk about also in the book, is the fact is you have gerrymandered maps here where the fix is in, number two. Number three is even in that district, the Republican got less than 50% of the vote and underperformed what the president got in his election by 8%. And the Democrat had done better than at any time before in that race. But there's no silver medal in politics. And I will say this, had Duke Cunningham run, Duke Cunningham would have been the ex-congressman.
Let's talk about your five ways that you think American politics need to change. We'll start with the creation of a new social contract, which sounds suspiciously like Newt Gingrich's contract with America. But some of these proposals will upset a lot of people because you call for universal citizen service. And I suspect people will have a problem with that. What is it?
Our proposal is very simple, that in an effort to bring the country together, we need to ask everyone to step up to the plate, and that one way to do that is to expect of every American between the ages of 18 to 25 that over the course of their youth, they spend 3 months in community civilian service, helping their community prepare for disaster, for terrorist attack, giving something back to their country.
A civilian service draft.
It's not a draft. Mm-hmm. It's not a draft. It's a universal expectation that everyone will have to do something for their community. It's not military. And we think, as Rahm said earlier, that George Bush had an opportunity after 9/11 to call Americans together, to ask everyone to do their part, that Americans were eager to do it, and that to make us safer, to bring us together, to find a way to unite the country, we need to have that kind of expectation.
And there's also a long history in our nation, whether that's a Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, but also, I mean, the idea even dates back, I think Harry Truman was proposing on the early days of the Cold War a similar concept to also to communicate that the country was ready for this long twilight struggle against communism. And if we're going to have this long fight against terrorism, we got to make sure every American has skin in the game and is prepared for it.
My guests are Rahm Emanuel, who was elected to the United States Congress from the district, the 5th District of Illinois in 2002. He's the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Bruce Reed, who writes a daily political column for Slate, is the editor-in-chief of Blueprint and is also the president of the Democratic Leadership Council. They both served as top aides in Bill Clinton's 1992 and 1996 campaigns and held top policy jobs in the White House. They've collaborated on a book called Big Ideas for America, which is published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Another one of your proposals in your new social contract is a universal children's health care. How would that system work?
Both Bruce and I worked on the Children's Health Initiative, which also was the health care package we negotiated in the balanced budget, which was for all the children of working parents who had no health care. And there was a classic case where the Republican Senate proposed one thing, we proposed another, and we ended up with what President Clinton wanted, which was pediatric care and eye and dental for these children. And the only group in the last 5 years whose coverage has actually gone up rather than a declining element of the population being covered is children, mainly because of the SCHIP program, the Children's Health Care Program. It's an acknowledgement that one of the great investments we're going to have to make is in our children. The governor from our state, my state of Illinois, has a program, the only state in the country, where you have universal coverage for all kids, regardless of precondition and income. And Senator Durbin and I have introduced that to basically have a all children's health care package for all kids. You would pay more as you make more money or have more kids per child. But it ensures that as we've succeeded in health care, in universalizing coverage for populations, elderly, poor, veterans, that the next stage should be universal care for all kids. And that would be a proper investment for America's future and also a good investment for our kids' health care.
Many people feel that the Clinton White House botched any opportunity to create universal health care. How did that experience color your proposals in this book?
Well, we learned plenty of lessons from that endeavor.
Is Ira Magaziner still on talking? Who's still talking to you?
Ira Magaziner is doing great work for President Clinton, fighting AIDS in Africa and elsewhere. But you know, what's very important is that we actually make some progress on healthcare. We don't think you could do it all at once. It's easy to promise things, harder to deliver. But we're in a situation where our companies are not going to be able to compete unless we take serious measures to hold down the cost of health care. And we've got lots of families, as Ram said, who are in very tough shape trying to provide health care for their children. Government is going to have to play a role in it, but it's going to have to be a system that is consistent with American values and that does make some common sense progress. President Bush had lots of promises on health care in the 2000 campaign. He hasn't kept a single one of them. We can't afford to go through another administration like that.
Let me also say one thing. Four presidents have tried to provide universal care. Four presidents have failed. Now, the ultimate goal, we do believe, should be universal care. But acknowledging that you're not going to upend one-sixth of the economy just to see, as we say in the book, the advocates of the status quo come forward and beat you, you know, bloody to a pulp. We got to solve this problem. We know the political system can't provide universal care and upend one-sixth of the economy. So what should be the next stage of what we've done as Medicare, Medicaid, veterans have shown? We say, next stage, all kids' health care. And in 2007, the actual children's health care program is up for renewal. And I think you're going to have not just a healthy debate, you're going to have Democrats and Republicans coming together to say, okay, every child in America should have health care, and set that goal and then start putting in place the policy, because that is the only way you're going to make progress on health care reform.
You call for fiscal responsibility, and isn't there a funny sort of irony about the Bush administration's fiscal policies? They've sort of abandoned the Reagan-era notion of cutting government spending, instead run up a pretty sizable deficit. But don't Democrats have trouble criticizing Republicans for that because of their image of being the tax and spend party?
Well, you use the word irony. There's a couple other adjectives I would use to describe what they've done to the budget.
Not during the hours that the FCC really monitors.
Well, I'm a member of Congress, and we also vote on their budget. look, they've added $3 trillion to the government's books of debt in less than 4 years. It's the largest increase in our nation's debt in the shortest period of time in American history. And Democrats have been the ones that have been the fiscal smart, prudent, and effective managers of our books, as we showed when we created not only a balanced budget, but 3 straight years of surplus. And I think people are tired of $1.8 trillion of empty trailers missing down in Katrina, $10 billion missing in Iraq, and nobody caring.
You've been mentioning the war on terror, and earlier I asked you what you think we should be doing in Iraq. You kind of evaded an answer. Do you think we should set a deadline? Do you think that, you seem to be also calling for a complete change in the way we approach our intelligence system.
Yeah, I think that's the important point.
You think the British are doing a better job? There are a lot of unhappy people in Britain now because of some recent developments there and the way that they are cutting down on civil liberties in their fight against terror.
Well, I think they appear to have done a very good job in stopping the plot to blow up the
turns out to be true. Not everybody thinks that. Some people are claiming in today's times that it may be a little overblown.
Well, I think better safe than sorry. But in any event, you know, if we're going to, as Ram said, this is going to be a long war on terror, and we need to change our approach. We need more allies, which the Bush administration has done everything it can to avoid having. We do say in the book that we're going to need more troops over the long haul. And above all, we're going to need better intelligence. We can't look at what happened. We've had the 9/11 attack that was in part an intelligence failure, a bureaucratic failure. We've set up the Homeland Security Department in Washington, which has 180,000 employees and is I think a classic Washington response to avoid solving the real problem. So I think what Democrats are trying to articulate is that the Bush administration has botched the whole thing.
Now, let me say one thing is that if it's a war on terror, even though whether it's – I think it's – so you said some people are claiming that the London thing is not as bad as – or not as big or not as grand. Look, they went and got trained. We know where they went. They went to Afghanistan, the Pakistani border. Where did we pull up before our job was done? Afghanistan, Pakistan border. When you look at what happened in Spain or in other places, and you assume my guest tells me, also in Germany, we left a place that was clearly the focal point and training area for the war on terror. And this is not just Democrats. These are national security experts say this, people in the armed forces, regardless of party or party position. And we went to Iraq and totally have missed where the center point is. Now, that being said, what we are seeing in Iraq is that, look, there's been 3.5 years of the president's policy, $308 billion. I gave you the human cost, both in deaths and wounded. Barely the green zone is occupied. Doing more of the same is failing. And I happen to think, that at least the Democrats are offering different strategies than just doing more of the same. And that's why I think Senator Biden and Senator Levin offer really good constructive ideas that ought to have the debate and outlook rather than I can't tell you what Senator Lugar or Senator Warner, who are the chairman of the Foreign Affairs and the Armed Services Committee, are telling you what they're going to do.
I was surprised that you've made no mention in this book of the so-called moral values issues. Why did you choose to leave out them all out of your 5-point list? Aren't abortion rights, gay marriage, school prayer, and the like major political issues these days?
They're major political issues, but look at the challenges the country is going to face in the near term. As Ram said, we need to put our economic engine back in gear so that we can compete with the likes of China and India. And to do that, we're going to need the kind of universal social contract that we talk about to make college more available, to make healthcare cheaper. We have the war on terror that we need to fight in a better way, and we need to ask more of our citizens. So, it's very easy for the politicians to find ways to divide the country. We need to find ways to unite the country. On issues like abortion, for example, there's a very broad consensus behind the kind of position that Senator Clinton and others have advocated, that we ought to be reducing the number of abortions while preserving the right to choice. The administration doesn't want to have that debate, because their goal is to divide us as much as they possibly can.
I think we wrote this as dealing with the challenges of the global economy and what's happened to what we grew up under and understood as kind of the one job, one pension, one mortgage, and that world has changed with no replacing concept. Number two, somebody said we do take on somewhere in the book on what's going on in the kind of the culture in the sense of what the values at Hollywood should be more. We understand the sanctity of the First Amendment, but the fact is, as two parents here, we'd like to have a culture that supports what we're trying to do at home with our kids rather than try to undermine it. That being said, this is not part of the book, but I'll just tell you this. In all the challenges America faces, I think the Constitution's really doing fine. I'll make a pledge with the Republicans. You leave the Constitution alone for 2 years. Let's try to tackle some of these things. And if we succeed at universal health care for kids, we can come back and muss up the Constitution all you want. But right now, 200 years of real success, over 200 years. Leave it alone for 2 years. Let's solve one or two of these problems, and you come back and play games with the Constitution.
Well, you've talked about uniting the country again. What about reuniting your party? What we saw in Connecticut is just a replay of what happened during the Clinton years, where a lot of liberals were upset by conservative economic policies at home and abroad, NAFTA and other things. They were upset by other things that they saw as capitulation to the right, even the appointment of a lot of Republicans to judgeships. And there has been a groundswell on the left of the Democratic Party, but neither of you represented. Are you just going to ignore it, or are you going to try to incorporate some of the complaints that we're hearing in defense of people like Ned Lamont?
Well, Democrats are very much united in our frustration with the Bush administration, our desire for a new Congress, our desire for a new president. That's what we're trying to speak to in this book. You know, what unites Democrats is our desire to solve the country's problems. And if you set aside the labels, if you set aside the political debates in Washington, and you talk about real ideas, then Democrats are very united. In fact, there are an awful lot of independents who embrace our ideas, and even many disgruntled conservatives and Republicans who are tired of an administration that fails at everything it tries.
Yeah. One of the things is the test here for Bruce and I, although both of us are clearly, if you want to look for labels of new Democrats, it's not about what is unites the party, and it's not about whether the left is more dominant or the center is more dominant. It's whether the idea works and solves the problem and whether it moves the country forward. I think this the Democrats, and I would say that I agree with Bruce, are united on that concept, and I don't care if an idea comes from what is called, quote-unquote, the traditional left or it comes from, quote-unquote, the new Democrat school. Does it solve a problem and move this country forward? And that's the kind of metric that is more important than what ideological label it carries.
Rahm Emanuel and Bruce Reed have co-authored Big Ideas for America. It is published by Public Affairs. Thank you both so much for being with us. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.